Well, here we are back with Hermeneutics, Principles of Interpretation. And quick review, we need to know this so that we learn to interpret what we are reading in the Bible correctly so that we don't mess things up and mess up our own lives by applying the Bible incorrectly to our lives and doing all kinds of really bad, silly things and then messing things up for our family and other friends that will look at what we're doing improperly and starting all kinds of goofy cults maybe, and don't want to do that. That would be bad. Five steps: historical, cultural, and contextual analysis, which we did, the lexical, syntactical analysis, theological analysis. Now we are into the literary or genre analysis. We're not really going to go into genres at all. We'll just do literary, and we're not going to go in. By literary analysis, we're going to just cover some more simple type things. We're not going to get into things like apocalyptic type things. That's a study all on its own. Well, that's supposed to be cultures. Thank you for pointing that out, Barb. Thank you. Yes. Okay. So I will try to. Yeah. Well, I'll try to take care of that for next time. Thank you. Okay. But yeah, we're not going to be covering cultures this week. We'll cover that next week, and cultures too. And that's actually kind of probably one of the more important things that we'll take care of. So historical, cultural, and contextual analysis was where we study the elements of history, culture, and context that might shed light on God's intended meaning. Lexical, syntactical analysis is where we look at the meaning of words in context, primarily going back to the Hebrew and the Greek, and sometimes even the Aramaic. Theological analysis is where we look at what, in context, what God revealed before and after the passage to help us what he meant there. Looking at the in context with salvation history, we did kind of a brief survey of the different types of salvation history that outlooks that different people have, so that you have an idea of when you're maybe looking at books, so that you don't go out and pick a study Bible or maybe a theological dictionary or something that is going to be incompatible with the church's teaching and what you believe, so that when you're doing a study you get all sorts of confusion and the wrong kinds of things. We don't want you maybe going to a Watchtower Society type of theological textbook and getting all kinds of goofy teaching there. And literary or genre analysis: what are the genres being used in this passage and what are the rules used for interpreting them properly? Okay, there are various literary methods. What we're going to be dealing with here are going to be the ways that people tell stories. Generally, we're going to be dealing with, as far as the New Testament goes, kind of the way that Jesus told stories. Old Testament, we'll be dealing with some of the ways that stories are told a little bit too, but there are various literary methods. They cannot all be handled the same way. Just like all games do not have the same rules, literary devices and genres each have their own rules. There will be a... When we talk about rules for handling these things, there will be some caveats that we'll get into later. And realize that these rules are a little artificial. That we kind of we impose these rules on on the text, and they're not hard and fast rules. And you'll understand as we get into this a little bit later. But why do you need to know these rules? If we don't all operate from the same set of rules, our interpretations will be different from each other. And also, if the rules aren't correct, our interpretations won't be correct either. Okay. Good communicators use a variety of literary devices for illustration, clarification, emphasis, and maintenance of audience interest. What that basically means is if we all talk exactly the same way and we're all very monotone and we don't use stories or illustrations or examples, and everybody's going to get really bored. And people like stories. If we don't use stories and we don't use examples, then everybody just kind of goes to sleep and daydreams, and then we start thinking of our own stories. People like stories, and people like cartoons. That's why we all watch movies and we watch TV, because we get bored with everything else. Okay, so first one that we're going to look at is what's called a simile. So people that we're going back to school now here, a simile are things that use the words like or as. For instance, people remember Jesus used the kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed. Okay, everyone remember that one? Kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed. The emphasis is on some point of similarity between two ideas, groups, actions, or something. The author is keeping the two things separate. Okay, kingdom of heaven, mustard seed. The two things are separate. Now, it's on a point of similarity. Now, what is the point of similarity between the kingdom of heaven and a mustard seed? It's not start small, goes larger. Simple beginning. Okay. But it's a single point. It's not many things. It's not a kingdom of heaven is like a mustard seed because it gets in your eye and it hurts. Right? It's not that. So it's a single point. It's not all kinds of things. We look at what was it that Jesus was actually making a point of. We don't make our own reasons for it. We look at why was Jesus actually making the point. Okay, now a metaphor, similar to a simile, but it's an unexpressed comparison. It doesn't use the words like or as, it's more like is. It's used is instead of like or as. But the person who's using it intertwines the two things. In this case, Jesus says, I am the bread of life. But is Jesus a loaf of bread? He is not Wonder Bread. But he says, I am the bread of life. Once again, is used to express a single point. Okay, now we're going on to proverbs. Okay, a proverb is, you know, a short statement. Once again, contains an important spiritual insight. Very condensed thing. Usually has a single point of comparison or principle of truth to convey. People tend to want to press a proverb in every point. But you can't really do that. Let's go to Proverbs 31:14. Now King Lemuel is talking about the woman of excellence. Now, this is a proverb about the virtuous woman. Okay? She's very industrious, but she is not like the merchant ship in that she is very, very wide. Right? She might be. Probably not. At least if he's making that comparison, he's not doing it when she's in the same room with him. Okay? At least I hope not. He's not going to stay king very long anyway. He's doing this. Okay, I like similes and metaphors. They, once again, usually convey a single point of comparison, and they're usually not intended to say all there is to say about a given situation or a topic. They also need to be applied within context. Very important that they're within context. Let's go to Proverbs 26, 4 and 5. Okay, read, if you read just 26, 4 by itself, and you don't read it without 5, it says, "Do not answer a fool according to his folly, lest you yourself also be like him." But verse 5 kind of says almost the opposite. Answer a fool according to his folly, lest he be wise in his own estimation. So you kind of balance the two against each other. Proverbs need to be taken in context. Remember also, this is the book of Proverbs and not the book of promises.
Okay.
So that's very important. It's, exactly the one that I was going to go to. That so many people just cling, and it's obviously a very good principle. I mean, but you train up your kid in the way they should go, and kids, so many are going to go down the wrong path. But that doesn't mean that they're not going to get hit by a bus before they come back. It's a good principle, obviously, and in the vast majority of cases, they are going to come back, but it's not always going to happen. It's the book of Proverbs, not the book of promises. Okay, now on to parables. Parables are very much like similes in structure. Generally, they use the words like or as in them. The speaker usually keeps things being compared separate again. For instance, Jesus, when he's talking, says, "The kingdom of heaven is like a man who sowed good seed in his field." And then he goes on, it's more, whereas a simile is a short statement, a parable is a story. And he starts off with, "Kingdom of heaven is like a man who sowed a good seed in his field." And then he goes on to an explanation. Usually he tells a story first, then he tells the interpretation if there is one. Isaiah 5, 1 through 7 is obviously not, but we're going to go back to that story later in another one. Let's turn to Isaiah 5, 1 through 7. The reason I'm going to that one is because we're going to be coming back to Isaiah when I talk about allegories in a minute. So you see back here in Isaiah, Isaiah is a parable, 5, 1 through 7 is a parable, and verse 7 is the interpretation of it. Okay. In a parable, usually there's a single comparison, what we call a focal idea or ideal, but sometimes there are some details that have such significance. So you can have extra details or things, but they all relate to that single focal ideal in there. There aren't extraneous ideals. They all relate to that one single central idea. So now we'll go ahead and go back to the parable of the soils at Matthew 13. And we don't necessarily have, just keep it open to look at. We don't need to read the entire chapter. Unless, is anybody here not familiar, you don't remember Matthew 13, you don't need to raise your hand and have everybody look at you like you don't know what's going on. Unless you're Bill, then you can. Okay. This is where the sower went out to sow, and the seed landed on the four different soils, and three of them are no good, but one of the seed sprouted up and yielded 60 and some 30 and some, you know, landed really good. The focal point is that the preaching of the word will meet various receptions in the lives of those that heard it. And Jesus goes on to elaborate on the four types of reception, and the details that are significant are all related to the one focal idea. And we see Jesus goes on and he elaborates on the four different soils. But all the details all relate to that one focal point, that the preaching of the word meets various receptions in the lives and the hearts of the people that hear it. Okay, now we'll get to allegories. And allegories, most people think that allegories are where teaching and preaching is where people really go awry the most. It's usually parables where most of it goes awry, because preachers generally pick out details that are incidental, and they will they'll take incidental details and they'll take great messages from them, but they take them out of context. And it's usually it's the parable where they make the messages completely going wrong with them. It's not actually the allegories, because they shy away from the allegories and they're scared to, they've been taught so much, stay away from the allegory, but they're not afraid of the parable. And so they take the parables out of context. So, but anyway, back to allegories now. Allegories are more like a metaphor in structure. They don't use words like or as. The subject or things being compared to are usually more intertwined. Let's go ahead and go to Psalm 80, 8 through 16. Pretty much it says basically the same thing that Isaiah 5, 1 through 7 said. But you see how it was more intertwined? There's no real interpretation, but it's all more direct as far as what it's saying. Do people kind of see that? Allegories are difficult. They're very hard. In an allegory, there may be several important ideas, and they don't necessarily converge. Whereas a parable has a single focal idea, allegories don't. They don't have to have a single focal point, and they don't all need to point in the same thing. We'll look at another one in a minute that's easier to pick up on. They may simply have one point after another that's just loosely tied together in a story, and you'll see that here in John 10, 1 through 18. Let's go there. It's Christ the Good Shepherd story that people are probably a little more familiar with. Okay. And just so the context, see, if you remember this, Jesus had healed the blind man, one been from birth, and the Sanhedrin had questioned him. And he basically said he didn't know who the guy was, or they'd thrown him out after basically said, what, do you want to be his disciple too? And they got really upset with him and excommunicated him. And so Jesus... Well, if you remember the story, Jesus tells in a very short... Well, I don't know. He says, I tell you the solemn truth, the one who does not enter the sheepfold by the door but climbs in some other way is a thief and a robber. The one who enters by the door is the shepherd of the sheep. The doorkeeper opens the door for him, and the sheep hear his voice. He calls his own sheep by the name and leads them out. When he has brought all his own sheep out, he goes ahead of them, and the sheep follow him because they recognize his voice. They will never follow a stranger, but will run away from him because they do not recognize a stranger's voice. So that's the first time he tells the parable, very shortly and compressed. Jesus told them this parable, but they did not understand what he was saying to them. So he tells it very shortly, and they don't get it. So Jesus said to them again, much slower. I tell you the solemn truth, I am the door for the sheep. All who come before me were thieves and robbers, but the sheep did not listen to them. I am the door. If anyone enters through me, he will be saved, and will come in and go out and find pasture. The thief comes only to steal and kill and destroy. I have come so that they may have life and may have it abundantly. I am the good shepherd. The good shepherd lays down his life for the sheep. The hired hand, who is not a shepherd and does not own sheep, sees the wolf coming and abandons the sheep and runs away. So the wolf attacks the sheep and scatters them. Because he is a hired hand and is not concerned about the sheep, he runs away. I am the good shepherd. I know my own, and my own know me, just as the Father knows me, and I know the Father, and I lay down my life for the sheep. I have other sheep that do not know me from the sheepfold. I must bring them too, and they will listen to my voice, so that there will be one flock and one shepherd. This is why the Father loves me, because I lay down my life so that I may take it back again. No one takes it away from me, but I lay it down of my own free will. I have the authority to lay it down, and I have the authority to take it back again. This commandment I receive from my Father. Okay. So there are several major teaching points of this. Jesus is the means of entry for salvation. Those come to God through him will be saved. So that's the first major teaching point. Second one, those who came before him were thieves and robbers who attempt to gain control of the sheep. He didn't give any real details about who the thieves and the robbers were. He didn't really need to do that. Isn't an important point. Next point is there's a contrast between Jesus the Good Shepherd and the hirelings. Main point is that he will lay down his life for the sheep. They will run away. He won't. Next one is Jesus has an intimate personal relationship with both the sheep and the Father. In the Greek, there's a word that he uses called gnosko. Gnosko means to know or to have a relationship of trust and intimacy with someone. This is why you go back to, the second or third one when we used the lexical syntactical analysis. This is why that's kind of an important point. While it was a fairly horrible night, that's why that's kind of an important lesson in knowing how to use the dictionaries or these days the computer programs, how to get into using the language tools, because those are pretty important, getting to know the difference in the different words that are used. Next one is Jesus' prophecy of others to be called to the fold. That particular verse, for those of you who know Mormons, this is a verse that they use to say that's when Jesus went to come to this country to call the Indians. Okay, if you've ever heard that one before, this is where they get that. Okay, probably not true. Okay, this is why we went over theological analysis, because you will hear goofy theologies out there. It's important to know your theology. Next teaching point Jesus uses is Jesus says he will lay down his life voluntarily. Not that the Pharisees are going to take it from him, that Jesus is going to lay it down voluntarily of his own free will. So you can see in this allegory there is not a single focal point of the story, that there are several teaching points. That it's all one story with several teaching points, that it's being all put to, being held together by the story. Okay, so three reasons why this is an allegory and not a parable. 6 points listed, all in a linear fashion, structured around more linear rather than a single focus. The meaning of the story is implicit within the story rather than added at the end. So, in other words, there's no interpretation thrown at the end like there would be in a parable. And there's no like or as thrown in at the beginning. Okay, the important caveat that I mentioned at the beginning. These rules, when we were doing these interpretations, we put these rules on the text in order to try to come up or try to have consistent interpretations. It's important to realize that the authors or the people that God used to write the Bible for him did not differentiate between similes and metaphors and parables and allegories like we do. In Hebrew, they had a word for all of it. It was meson. In Greek, it was parabole, where we get the word parable from. One word in each language that covered everything. So they didn't have a word for simile. They didn't have a word for parable. They didn't have a word for allegory. It was just one word that covered a story, and that was it. So you need to keep that in mind. So you have, when you're going over these, realize that you're looking at the author's intention when he was using these. So what is the best way to try to figure out what was going on or what he was trying to do? Context. Once again, everything goes back to context. So you look at each story in its historical context and you ask, what was the intended point as he told the story? Don't take, once again, I mentioned this before, don't take incidental details and get creative. It might be edifying to somebody, but it's still called eisegesis. If you remember that word from a few weeks back, you don't put your own meaning into it. A great sermon, wrong text. It's called allegorizing a parable. You look at what was he trying to say. Try to look at what was Jesus trying to say. The mustard seed is, the kingdom of heaven is not like a mustard seed in that it hurts when it gets in your eye. Okay. Any questions at all?